Welcome to the History Section. I'm Ben Kyler, and here with me I have my guest Larry DiFerrero, author of Brothers in Arms. Just to get right into it, Larry, can you touch on your background as a historian? Like, you know, what influenced you to pursue history and why you think it's like such an important study?
First, thanks for inviting me, Ben. I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk about the work and what it means. I'm a naval architect. I designed ships for many decades. It's an engineering discipline, and you wouldn't think that being a naval architect would draw me immediately into history. But what I learned from my colleagues fairly early on in my career is that history is one of the tools we use to understand the why. When you're doing any kind of large project, whether it's building a building or designing a ship, you have to understand the rationale, the why. And since my field was in warship design, we had to understand strategy. We had to understand the historical bases. And it was that study of the why that led me to think much more about studying history itself as a discipline. So I came upon the idea that my field of naval architecture had never had a history written the way that histories of civil engineering and automobiles and aircraft engineers have had histories. So I decided that that would be something I could tackle as a PhD thesis, which I was able to do when I began work for what's called the Office of Naval Research. It's a major part of the U.S. Navy's research and development ecosystem. And there's an international office in London, which I worked in for several years in the early 2000s. While I was there, I was able to pursue my PhD in the history of science and technology at Imperial College London. And my thesis was about the story of the development of naval architecture in the age of sail, and really in the scientific revolution, the idea being that at the time, the scientific revolution with all of the different academies and people who headlined development of the sciences and maths like Euler and Newton, very often were doing so with the government as the primary source of funding, and very often it was the navies who, in this age of empire expansion, saw science as a way to improve the design, the building, the navigation of its navy. It was something that the military would call today a force multiplier. So I finished that thesis. I was able to publish the book, which was called Ships and Science, in 2006. I went on to continue the story of naval architecture with another book called Bridging the Seas, which takes us to the modern age. I found as I was writing these histories that I saw many other threads that caught my attention, and it didn't specifically have to do with the navies or engineering. For example, one of the themes that I thought was fascinating was international science in the early days of the scientific revolution. So I wrote about a scientific mission headed by France and Spain to the equator, actually today's Ecuador, but also known at the time as Peru, which was intended to determine the correct size and shape of the Earth, which would aid navies in navigation. And that was published, and now it's being translated into Spanish. I then wrote Brothers in Arms, and I'll get to that a little bit later as to the rationale, which had to do with alliances and partnerships. And even today, I'm still interested in the idea of science as part of a partnership of nations, if you will, scientific diplomacy. My most recent book came out just a couple of years ago, is titled Churchill's American Arsenal, the partnership behind the innovations that won World War II. And that deals with the development of things like airborne radar and some things that people think of as all-American, like the P-51 Mustang fighter, which turns out to have been a British design, British specifications and American design, but the British first put it into service. I was more about the two nations working together in the scientific and engineering fronts to create weapons and inventions that had never been seen before in order to win against some very implacable enemies. Germany and Japan both were quite scientifically and technically advanced, and it required this cooperation between the two countries, Britain and the United States, in order to develop the war-winning inventions. And just as a shout-out, since the Academy Awards, as we speak, have just been announced, Oppenheimer is leading the Best Picture category. What is not spoken about in the movie is that the atomic bomb began, in fact, as a British project, and it was only through that British and American cooperation that Oppenheimer and the rest of the Manhattan Project were able to design, develop, and build a bomb that really brought the war to a close, and that's left out of that story. So a lot of what I try to do as an historian is talk about those relationships and that framework that America has never done anything all by itself. It's always been part of a larger coalition or series of partnership.
I think that, I mean, obviously it's important to reframe our understanding of history anyway, because the primary education that we receive, or at least that I received when I was, you know, before I entered college, definitely wasn't a sufficient understanding of American history. But I think what you're doing is part of a larger trend of people who are recognizing that American history didn't happen on its own. You know, I think oftentimes, you know, traditional narratives kind of frame it as America versus the rest of the world, especially with, you know, the revolution, with, you know, especially the Second World War. So I appreciate that you've decided to take that task on in expanding, broadening the horizons in which we consider, you know, technological innovations. And, you know, who knows, maybe in a few years you'll start a book on Oppenheimer and you can talk about how that was also a transnational project, and I can have you back on here for that. On the topic of reframing America, what specifically motivated you to look at the revolution as an international event and kind of reframe it as, you know, really an international cooperation of empires?
It began with engineering. It began with naval architecture, as I'm going to argue from time to time, as does everything. When I was doing my research at Imperial College London on the naval architecture, shipbuilding, etc., during the Age of Sail, one interesting item I found was that there was a lot of technological and scientific exchange between nations, especially France, Britain, and Spain during that time. Science never stayed in a inside the borders, neither did engineering. And one of the things that happened during these interminable conflict between those three nations was that engineers and shipbuilders were often seen as tools of improving alliances. And so specifically, France and Spain, after what's called the Seven Years' War — we called it the French and Indian War and was precursor to the American Revolution — those two nations, France and Spain, had lost very badly to Britain and decided they needed to beef up their navies, because if you were going to defeat Britain and you were living in the 18th century, you had to do it, you know, through a navy. Now, Britannia rules the waves, remember? So each nation understood they couldn't defeat the British navy on its own, but the two together allied could do that. And so they exchanged engineers, they exchange artillery, artillery engineers, they exchange shipbuilders, and they were preparing to build a combined fleet, kind of a NATO before NATO. And they were going to use that to exact revenge against the British. And again, in my research, I found that it was that united French-Spanish Navy that was the most critical to the defeat of the British and therefore of American victory in the Revolutionary War. And I read about this and realized it, included it in my thesis, and didn't think about it too much until my children were starting to learn about the American Revolution in school a few years later. And I, as I looked in their textbooks, I saw France was barely mentioned. Spain was completely absent. And I began to wonder, why is there such a disconnect between what I saw, what I knew, and what was in the history books? I looked for books on the roles of France and Spain together in the American Revolution, found almost none. And even the more scholarly works that have been fairly recently completed barely mentioned that the two nations were in the fight, or they didn't talk about at all how it was necessary for America to lean on the French and French and Spanish navies in order to win. Briefly put, this was the myth that I saw in these history books. During the American Revolution, George Washington suffered a series of defeats, mostly defeats, over the course of 8 years against the British, and yet somehow, in the year 1781, was able to pull out a victory at Yorktown over Lord Cornwallis, and that victory, that single victory after 8 years of pretty continuous defeats, was what brought Britain to the peace table. And that always seemed to be odd, not quite right. What I learned was that this was nothing of the sort. America prevailed, and this is what I write about in Brothers at Arms, because both France and Spain had a goal of taking out revenge, and that's the word that the French and the Spanish together used against the British, and they had every intention of making the War of American Independence the venue, the tool, in order to knock the British down a peg. So the three nations together had a common goal, defeat a common adversary, Britain. And it was also because the three were able to work together. They're not always in full alliance, but certainly in partnership and coalitions, not just with them, not just between America, France, and Spain, but there were other partners that entered into the conflict, the Netherlands, and then in India, the Kingdom of Mysore. So every one of them had a common goal, defeat the British adversary. They all were working towards a common end. They didn't always work completely together, but they certainly recognized how common their interests were. And ultimately, it was not the American victory at Yorktown, but rather the combined French and Spanish navies, which together outnumbered, outmaneuvered, and eventually overwhelmed the British Navy. And that's what brought the British to the peace table. So to be clear, it wasn't Yorktown. Yorktown was a temporary defeat for the British, but they still had a massive number of troops on the North American continent. It wasn't a fatal blow in terms of their ability to continue carrying out the fight. But when the French and the Spanish, as a united armada, was victorious in Florida, they were able to take the British possessions there. They were victorious in the Mediterranean. They were able to take the island of Menorca. They were threatening Gibraltar. And then they had a specific plan to threaten the British interest in the Caribbean, which was where Britain was making most of its money, in the sugar plantations of the Caribbean islands. And they had amassed a fleet that in Cadiz in Spain, along with a couple of other fleets in the Caribbean, that together would have descended upon the primary British port in Jamaica. Undoubtedly, they would have been able to take it because by that time, the British fleet in the Caribbean was had been decimated by several events, including a series of hurricanes, as well as other defeats at the hands of their enemies. When Britain realized that it was going to lose its overseas empires in the Caribbean and Mediterranean, it was on the verge of losing its foothold in India. They realized that all of this was much more important than these American colonies, and that peace was the best way to maintain their global overseas empires. And it wasn't the Americans who made the British realize where their interests were. It was Spain and France that made them realize this. Now, every one of the participants was exhausted by 1782 and 1783. They had been spending money, arms, and people, and ships, and they barely saw a military end, and so they had to negotiate a peace. And it was that that threat of an overseas empire being taken away from them that brought the British to the peace table.
Yeah, see, that international framing of it, I think, is just so, I mean, it contradicts kind of what you're taught when you're young. But I think that's so important to learn, because you can see that, you know, the difference between how you describe it, how it actually occurred when you account for the international circumstances of the war and Britain's greater empire that was at threat, or that was having a bit of a word fart here, was under threat of being taken by their imperial adversaries. And, you know, like you said, they judged that to be more important than losing in America. But it's funny how, you know, when you look at it from like traditional narratives, you know, it's framed as a series of defeats, and then America wins kind of like a critical
decisive victory.
Yeah,
and it was decisive.
And then, and then it kind of just skips to peace talks. The actual reasons why Britain came to the peace table are very, I guess, the methodology for selecting them, or for selecting which ones to highlight in American history textbooks, are very selective. Before I was 18, the only French involvement I understood in the Revolutionary War was Lafayette. You know, we've got Lafayette Square in D.C., but you don't hear anything. I mean, like you said, you hear nothing about the Spanish. Until I read your book, I didn't even know the Spanish were involved in the war, which that was, you know, almost made me feel stupid, because it's like, this is a whole international empire that I just didn't know about. And it was, you know, it was really eye-opening. But I think that, that reframing of history is so important in order to address the rest of American history and how it actually took place.
We're working on it. It's taking longer than we thought, but we're definitely working to reframe it.
No, I mean, you're doing important work, though. I mean, that's, even if it takes, you know, decades to do, I think it's incredibly important.
Thank you.
Hey, if you made it this far, thanks for listening. And if you want to hear more, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or visit thehistorysection.com to catch future episodes.
Regarding your source base, and I guess just research in general for something of this magnitude and this in an effort to reshape American history, how do you go about curating your source base as diverse as what you referenced in Brothers at Arms?
Well, I knew from the start that it was going to be a pretty heavy lift. So after I finished one of my earlier books, I got the usual question that every reader will get from a book agent once they finished their book. It's, what's your next project? What's your next book? And I realized that what was being left out of my kids' history book was a story. And I told my agent, that's Michelle Tesler, that I was pretty certain there was an untold story there, but I needed some time to figure out what that story was. And so for several years, I dragged my entire family, kids and my wife, through battlefields and encampments up and down the East Coast, all the way from upstate New York and Vermont, all the way down to Savannah, just to see where all of these conflicts that involve France and Spain took place. I'd already had experience in the archives, not just in the United States, but in Europe. So I was able to draw on some of the research that I'd done and continued that research. And most importantly, I found the historians I needed to talk to who knew something about the participation of these different nations in the conflict. Historians in France and Spain, in the Netherlands, Dutch, and so on. And the rule I quickly developed was I learn more from talking to an expert for 10 minutes than I do spending 10 hours or even 10 days in an archive. It is an absolute requirement that you find the experts first, find out what it is they already know and where they can point you to make the most use of your time. And so I pulled out their names in my book. I won't do that right here, but if you have a chance to read the book, go to the acknowledgement section, and every single one of those people that I have called out were just vital to understanding the roles and filling in the blank. Probably one of the toughest things I had to consider as I was sitting down to write the book was how to pull all these different threads together, because there were, all told, 5 nations fighting, or 6 nations, sorry, fighting over the course of 8 years, plus the periods before and after the war. So in order to bring it together and have it make sense chronologically and geographically, because this conflict was being fought across many theaters of war, not just on the North American continent, but as I mentioned, the Caribbean, also in Central America, also in South America, also in Africa, in the Mediterranean, in the North Sea, all the way to India. So it was a world war. And pulling all those together and making them and making the whole thing make sense meant that I had to be very focused on who were the events and the people that I should use as the through line for the story. So I really kept it to a few key individuals. To give you 2 examples, I think you mentioned the French fighting that Lafayette was the one person you learned about. But in fact, Rochambeau, who was the French general who fought alongside Washington at Yorktown, was an incredibly important figure. So were several French admirals and sailors. Comte de Grasse springs to mind, because without him, the Battle of the Chesapeake, which cemented control, Allied control of the Chesapeake, led to Yorktown. And also on the Spanish side, Bernardo de Galvez. He was the Spanish general who led the combined French-Spanish forces to defeat the British at Pensacola, putting Florida, or West Florida, into Spanish hands, driving the British out, which meant that the Spanish now had control over the Gulf of Mexico, temporary control over the Caribbean. And because of that, the French were able to Comte de Grasse was able to take his entire fleet from the Caribbean, which they were determined to protect, and go north to support the French and American troops in Yorktown. These were all related. And in this entire picture, you actually saw very little of Lafayette having direct strategic impact on the outcome of the war. He was present. He was, in fact, a very, he became a respected general in his own right. is not to take anything away from the experience that he developed over the course of the war. But in terms of strategic impact, I could name, just off the top of my head, 4 and 5 individuals who changed the outcome of the war more dramatically. And Lafayette, for reasons I'll get to in a little bit, was the one who eventually took the headlines. So bringing these people to the front of the narrative is, it is and was and is my intention, and in fact was the inspiration for the title of the book, Brothers at Arms, because these were men at arms, and their experience in fighting and conflict together made them, as Washington said of Rochambeau, brothers. And they, like almost in any conflict, became very close as a result of that conflict, and that that the individual relations between the two armies translated to a much broader alliance between our nations, sometimes more friendly than others. France is, of course, our oldest ally. Spain did not become an official ally for many, many years, but we've always had a, like any brothers, relationships that just went up and down. And that really was the rationale for calling the book Brothers at Arms, because of what I found as that that coalition relationship between the partners.
Just to rush into the next question, because I really want to know, I really want to hear your thoughts on how Lafayette became kind of the symbolic figure of France's involvement in the war. How do you believe understanding this history, as you've told it in your book, is important for fostering perspectives on other past events? It could be American history, but just history as a whole. You know, I guess in other words, why is it important to be aware that history does not take place in a vacuum?
One thing you probably never heard Karl von Clausewitz say is that history is the continuation of politics by other means. He should have, but he didn't. And his wife, who actually wrote Vom Krieg on War, Marie von Clausewitz, the subject of a very good biography I'm reading right now, probably thought about that, but it didn't appear in the writing. When Clausewitz and the Clausewitz couple said war is a continuation of politics by other means, what they meant was it does not live in a vacuum. There are political ends for carrying out a conflict. You're trying to achieve something that can be done by different means, but war is one of them. One of the other ways you can achieve political outcomes is by writing and rewriting history. And it has been written and rewritten ever since the war was being fought. The very first histories of the American Revolution were penned while the conflict was still underway. And what you see when you look through those very early histories, the ones written during the conflict, immediately after the peace treaties were signed, all the way through the early 1800s when the people who fought were still alive, is that the roles of France and Spain figured quite heavily, because there was an understanding at the time that the War of American Independence was a continuation of the European great power struggle that had been going on for, well, about 100 years by that point. Again, mostly between the nations of France, Great Britain, and Spain. I mentioned the Seven Years' War, which we call the French and Indian War, but that was probably the largest of the conflicts that eventually drew in many of the nations in Europe, but it was fought globally. It was a war of empire. American Revolution was also a war of empire. And the American and British and other historians understood this, and that's how they wrote about it. As the participants in the battles began to die off, the histories began to change. And probably the most important change that you see in the way the international perspective was written about was when Lafayette was invited to make a grand tour of the United States in 1824 and 1825. That was about the 50th anniversary of the War of American Independence. And he was invited to tour all of the states. I think there were 24 at the time. Curiously enough, the thing that continued to catch his attention was the increased, just the use of steam, steam boats, steam ferries in particular, which didn't really exist in France. Now, by this time, Lafayette had not only come back from the United States, he was not wreathed in glory, but he was known. Not as well known necessarily as the other participants, Rochambeau, De Grasse, but he was known. He made a name for himself during the French Revolution. He supported the rights of man. He was actually imprisoned for many years as a proponent of democracy. So that certainly cemented his reputation overseas and to some extent in the United States. When he came to the U.S. in 1824, he was hailed as the hero of two worlds. That was when that phrase was first coined. And during that 24-state visit over the course of 2 years, he was feted in almost every city, major city, where he stayed. That his visits were commemorated. Towns were named after him, Fayetteville in Indiana, Lafayette. There's several dozen cities and towns named for him. Locations in the cities, Lafayette Square, you mentioned, in Washington, D.C. So by the time he left, and then after he died in 1834, the reputation of Lafayette as a centerpiece of the French participation in the war, and by extension, the entire international participation, was complete. He was the one figure who came over and, alongside George Washington, helped to defeat the British. People like Bernardo de Galvez completely disappeared. If you're going to point the finger at one person who was responsible for the effacement of everyone except Lafayette in the story of the American Revolution, you have to point to George Bancroft. Now, he was the best-known historian of the 19th century. He'd been Secretary of the Navy, had many roles, diplomat. Probably his best historical role was as the author of a 10-volume history of the United States, and that was written between 1834 and like 1870s. So it took him many decades to write, and it covered the entire United States history from the time of the Vikings all the way till, early 19th century. And in those volumes, which served as the basis for most American histories for generations after that, he was very partisan in the way he was depicting American and foreign involvement. Now, one of the things that Bancroft was also known for was as one of the most partisan opponents of what was called Manifest Destiny. Manifest Destiny started in the 1820s and 1830s, was the idea that America was destined to rule the continent, probably, and probably at the time, the idea of extending its influence over all of the Western Hemisphere. Remember, 1820s, 1830s, this is when the Spanish colonies south of the United States were throwing off the shackles of Spain. Brazil had become independent from Portugal. So the idea that America could also influence the rest of the Western Hemisphere was right there at the forefront of Manifest Destiny. Bancroft was one of the flag wavers. And if you think about the role of Spain in that Manifest Destiny narrative, Spain's still trying to get maintain influence in the Western Hemisphere. It did not release its colonies easily. It was a long, drawn-out, bloody fight country by country. And also, Spain, or in the case of its descendants, the Spanish colonies of Mexico, for example, they were an impediment to American westward expansion. So Spain was not the country that you wanted to highlight in the role of a partner in with the Americans during the revolution. In Bancroft's writing, Spain is completely effaced. Either they're effaced or they're considered to be untrustworthy. They worked against the French. And this is Bancroft's writing. It was completely untrue, actually the exact opposite, because France and Spain worked together. They worked together all the time. France did not take a step without considering Spain and vice versa. That was the real story. But in Bancroft's narrative, Spain was the enemy, almost as untrustworthy as Britain. By the same token, Bancroft also elevated the role and the narrative of Lafayette to the point where Lafayette was featured on the inside cover of one of the volumes, one of Bancroft's volumes, not George Washington, Lafayette. So that tells you quite a bit about what Bancroft was trying to do. That narrative, that story, that storyline that that Bancroft created became the basis for American history, the one that I read, the one that my kids read, the ones that you read, pretty much through the 20th century. And it's only now in the very late 20th century and now in the 21st century that we as a nation are starting to recognize our cultural roots, where we've always been a multicultural nation, but we're coming to understand it better, especially in terms of our Spanish, Hispanic, Latin, Iberian roots. And it's one reason why people such as Bernardo de Galvez is coming to the fore. In fact, in 2014, Congress made Bernardo de Galvez an honorary American citizen, alongside Lafayette, alongside Winston Churchill, one of only six non-Americans to be so honored thus far. And that narrative, again, is changing because the politics of the time is changing. We have gone long, for a very long time past manifest destiny and the idea of America ruling the continent. And we are coming to the a better understanding of us as a nation of many, not just the nation of one. And I think that international outlook is why there's renewed interest that kind of was left off the table all the way back in the 18th century for viewing the American Revolution not as a singular American experience, but rather as an international event.
So the message we should be taking away from this is screw George Bancroft. No. I mean, those are pretty poignant words, especially I think with the concept of manifest destiny influencing so much of American history. I've always thought that, I guess, the kind of Cold War, covert actions we took in Latin America and the idea that we're owed sort of this hegemony of the Western Hemisphere almost is like a spiritual continuation of manifest destiny. But it's interesting to see how, our history written from that perspective still influences us just at a primary school level. Now, as far as unraveling these national narratives, you know, like American exceptionalism, the myth, what you call the myth of heroic self-sufficiency and placing history in a broader context, how important is accomplishing that?
Well, as I've said, very important because you look at creation myths as a kind of a guide for understanding a character is, if you're doing the creation myth in a television or movie series. And the creation myth of a nation helps guide you to understand what that nation is about. It's very difficult to completely escape your roots. So when you look at the creation myth of the United States, I think it's important to discard that idea that it was heroic self-sufficiency, as you said. This concept that the United States somehow bootstrapped itself from colony to a nation that it went from being a small collection of individuals, fought a war, and gained independence all by itself without any help. That was never correct, and it was never a good fit for who we are. In fact, if you reframe the question, if you think more along the lines of United States in that larger picture, it's the fact that we knew at the time that we had to lean on the partnerships and alliances with others, in this case, France and Spain, who came to the assistance of the United States even before the first battles were fought. The very first aid coming to the rebels, as they were called in correspondence from Europe, came from Spain first, then from France, before the first shots were even fired. It began before we started to fight. It continued after the war was won. And the fact is, the United States never would have been able to achieve victory, never would have been able to win a war against Great Britain without the assistance and partnership of its, well, assistance of its partners and allies, France and Spain. So the story of the American Revolution, this is what I say in my book, and this is what I say in almost every book talk that I make, the story of the American Revolution is that the American nation was born as the centerpiece of an international coalition which worked together to defeat a common adversary. And that's the creation narrative that we need to be talking about and understanding, because it bears very heavily on who we are as a nation today.
Especially, you know, the concept of America as the result of an international coalition. I think it really speaks to how our origins are international. We didn't come from one people. We are ourselves a coalition, you know, born from immigration. I mean, of course, also, you know, the genocide of indigenous peoples and colonial expansion. But aside from that, we're not essentially homogenous like many of these creation myths would lead us to believe. Those same myths kind of frame us as separate or others, you know, this heroic small fighting force that beat the odds and manages to topple this evil empire. You know, it's like Star Wars, essentially, where when in reality, I think you would agree with this, the reality of the, you know, being the centerpiece of an international coalition speaks to, you know, seizing the opportunity, which is in itself a better virtue, I think, than just to say, oh, we pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps. You know, highlighting the significance of logistics and innovations, kind of like in your book about the alliance between the technological alliance between Britain and America, how it's those little aspects like logistics, you know, like you mentioned in the book, how the American rebels received firearms from like smuggling ports in Amsterdam. Those, I think, make for a much more insightful and fascinating creation narrative than just, oh, we won because we're special. Because I think that, you know, being an international coalition is special in its own way.
Agreed. And, you know, the specialness of America, which is often referred to as American exceptionalism, has been talked about pretty much since the United States was being created. I've always argued that America is exceptional, not because of any innate trait that it has in its people, but rather because among nations, we surprisingly have been more capable of adopting great ideas and experiences from around the world and making them our own. And I think frankly, having lived overseas, we do this better than almost any other place. And one of the things that makes America exceptional today goes back to that idea of being able to look to international partners, work with them, adapt and adopt the ideas and the and very often the experiences of people themselves, and work together as part of a larger partnership. I've often said that we're most exceptional when we go back to those roots, the ones that started us in the revolutionary in the American War of American Independence, Revolutionary War, and lead these coalitions of nations in pursuit of a common good. Now, I don't just mean NATO. I don't just mean military alliances in places like Europe, Eastern Europe, that we're seeing today, or in the Indo-Pacific, which we're very concerned about. It's not just military, but it's about the other threats, the more important threats, the ones that are actually existential. The problems of inequality, the problems of climate change, the problems of pandemics. These are the threats that the United States is facing alongside its international partners. And it's when we work together with the United States, very often at the head of these coalitions, to defeat these threats. The most recent example, very fresh in everyone's mind, is the fact that we were able to develop COVID-19 vaccines only because we were part of this larger multinational research and development program that included universities and laboratories and governments from around the world all pulling together to get a bead on the problem and come up, and the operation, I think, was called Warp Speed, and develop these vaccines in a record amount of time. So my concluding remark is alliances always beat going it alone, every single time.
That's an incredible place to end it. I think that is, I appreciate your insights, aside from, the giant body of work that you presented us in Brothers in Arms. I encourage everyone listening, if you haven't read it, to go read it, because it is genuinely an eye-opening read, and it will make you reconsider other parts of American history and maybe even international history that you've been told is one way but actually happened another. Thank you so much, Larry. I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to show up and talk.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. This has been very enjoyable.